Genesis 3, 1 through 7, the fourth talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on March 12, 2000 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Chapter 3. We're working our way through Genesis. So far, all that we've seen has been good. God made everything good. He made things for man. Man is the culmination of the creative activity. And man is the main character then that's going to be in this drama of history that works its way out. God has demonstrated himself to be very generous towards man, provided for him, and he provided him with a garden that was well equipped with things that were valuable to man, including food. And God also provided for man a helpmate in Eve. God gave to man meaningful work to do, something that gave him significance, and he's kind of a co-worker with God. So everything God did was providing for man and setting things up for him. There was only one restriction placed on man, and that was that he was not to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But now in chapter 3, we see that man had a weakness. There was a weakness that was built into him from the beginning, and that weakness becomes apparent. Let's read the first half of chapter 3. Now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Indeed, hath God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden?" And the woman said to the serpent, "From the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat. But from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat from it or touch it, lest you die." And the serpent said to the woman, "You surely shall not die. For God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from the fruit and ate. And she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together, and made themselves loin coverings. This is one of my favorite chapters in Genesis. It's a strange chapter to be a favorite, but it's my favorite because it is so dense-packed and it is so illuminating. It's really a remarkable section. It starts with the appearance of this serpent who was the craftiest, the most subtle creature of the field that God made. Apparently, this as it goes on, as the account proceeds in the end of chapter 3, I think it becomes clear that this is not an ordinary serpent, that in fact there's some power behind this serpent, and yet the serpent was an appropriate vehicle for that power behind the serpent. This was the most appropriate animal for this other power. He was subtle. You can think of a serpent, they are always a little bit eerie. The way they move, they're quietly, and always sticking their tongues out. There's something a little bit weird about serpents. And eerie, because they're quiet and ominous. In any case, this is the animal that was chosen, I presume, by Satan to play this role. But notice that even this creature was a creature that was made by God. Now, this serpent engages the woman and has interaction with him. And it's curious, he just comes on the scene. We don't hear anything about him until chapter 3. But as soon as he opens his mouth, there's some things that become clear. One is, he knows a lot. This serpent seems to have inside knowledge. And takes advantage of that. The second thing that's really significant as we work our way through this interaction is the serpent never tells a lie. Take note of that. Everything that he says can be construed in a way that is true. And the other thing is, he knows right where the weak spots are. And he goes for the weak spots. Okay, what does he say? He doesn't start out with a statement. He starts out with a question. And his question is, has God said that you shall not eat from the trees of the garden? Now, it says, in some translations, it says, all the trees of the... I'm interested to see. Some translations say, from any tree of the garden. And then the marginal note usually says, or every tree of the garden. The Hebrew can be taken either way. So it's hard to know whether he's saying, is it true that God has said that all of the trees are off limits? Or is he saying, is it true that God has placed some restrictions on you? He could be, with his question, he could be asking either of those things. It's interesting that Eve's response is not a yes or no response. She's going to repeat the command rather than saying yes or no, which could imply that she didn't know which way to take the question. In any case, what's interesting is the serpent is pretending to be ask a simple, innocent question. And yet there's nothing innocent about this question. The serpent doesn't want to know the answer to the question. He is trying to put the woman into a mindset. He's trying to get the woman to focus on an aspect of the command, a particular aspect of the command. And that is the restriction, the limitation. He is essentially asking the woman to focus on what God has said is out of bounds to them, off limits to the man and the woman. He says, has God said? If we compare back to the account in chapter 2 where the command was first given, it says God commanded, and then it lists the command. The serpent asks, has God said, rather than saying, has God commanded? There are a number of subtle things happening here that we want to pay attention to, because I think that they are all very significant. So the serpent is downplaying the fact that this is a command, and he is emphasizing the restriction. The example that I have used other times when I've taught this, and I will use it again because I can't think of a better one, is
Say I have a glass of water here that comes up to the midpoint of the glass. There are two ways that I can describe this glass of water. I can say it is half full, or I can say it is half empty. Both are true. The only question is, to which do I want to bring the attention? To what is there, or to what isn't there? The serpent has said, focus on the restriction. Focus on what God has said that you cannot do. That's the intent of the serpent's question. It is not an innocent question. Now, this question was very productive. We can tell from the woman's response that it was very effective. Let's look at there are five differences between what was actually commanded and what the woman says. They're all just little differences. If you look at what was originally commanded and then read what the woman says, it seems like it's essentially the same thing. And in fact, it is essentially the same thing. But there are five differences of language. And throughout this account, I'm convinced that every little word was chosen carefully by the author. And I think that we'll see here that that's the case. Let's look at the five differences. So we'll be going back and forth between chapter 2, verse 16 and 17, and then what the woman says in chapter 3, verse 2. The first difference is that and this is the one that I'm the least certain of, what the significance of it is. But in the first one, God said that you may eat from any tree of the garden. In the woman's response, she says that we shall not eat from the fruit of the tree. So the difference is just the word fruit, which I think is indicating that she has not been entirely indifferent to this fruit. She has noticed it, and it has been interesting to her. The second difference, God had said, from any tree of the garden you may eat freely. When the woman restates it, she says that God said that we may eat. The difference there is she has omitted the liberality, the generosity that God included in his commandment. The third difference, God had said, from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you may not eat. She says that God said, the tree which is in the middle of the garden, you may not eat. This is very interesting because God had indicated by name the tree that they weren't supposed to eat from. The woman indicates it by geographical location. The name of the tree, as I pointed out last week, almost cries out to you to ask the question, why is it named that? God did not name it Gravenstein. He named it the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And we know what those words mean separately, but what is the significance of that phrase? It calls out to human curiosity to ask the question, why did he name it that? But apparently she has not reflected on that. The significance of the name has not made an impact on her thinking. It's just the tree in the middle of the garden. It's just that one. Next, God said, you shall not eat from it. She says, you shall not eat nor touch. So she's added touch. That was not part of the commandment. By adding touch, it makes it sound as though God is even more restrictive than the commandment is. And the fifth, God had said, in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. She said, in the day we eat of it, you will die. She left off both in the day. Whoops, did I say in the day? She didn't say in the day. She omitted in the day, the immediacy, and God had said, you shall surely die. And she left off the certainty. So both the immediacy and the certainty of the punishment were omitted in what the woman said. I think that this is extremely interesting because God made Adam and Eve to be knowers. We know that. We know that God built into man an intellectual curiosity. Because the first thing that God said to man was, I want you to name the animals. And why did he want him to name the animals? So that man would come to the realization that man needed a helpmate. So God made us to be knowers, learners. God gives this command to Adam and Eve, but apparently they didn't reflect on the command. They haven't really thought about, why was this command given? What's the significance of it? What's God up to? And in particular, they haven't thought about the significance of the name of the tree. Had they done so, and had they done so in the context of all of God's love and provision for them, they probably would have come to an understanding of that commandment that would have stood them in good stead in this time of temptation. But having never thought about it, the serpent can come along and suggest a whole different significance for the command in a different context, that is a context of mistrust. Turn it completely around and make it sound like a devious thing that God is up to. But by the response that Eve gives, it's clear that she is susceptible and ready for manipulation. The serpent knows now that she is not prepared. She hasn't thought about what this commandment is. She hasn't thought about the graciousness of God. Let's think about what could she get out of this commandment if she had thought about it in the context. If you recall, the commandment was given when Adam was placed in this garden that God had just provided for him. Graciously provided for him. It's a wonderful place. And then he gives this commandment. In that context, it is clear then that God loves and is providing for man. So what is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil is this thing placed in the garden that forces man to decide how he knows what is good and what is evil, what is right and what is wrong. How does man know what is good and evil? Well, in the context of trust, if God is a trustworthy God, if God really does love and care about man, if God really is the creator, who clearly knows more than man, the creator of human existence, the creator of all of life, clearly he knows more than man. If God says it is good, then it is good. If God says it is evil, then it is evil. How do we know what is good and evil? It's what God says. How do I know that I ought not eat this tree? Because God said, don't eat it. Think about when the commandment was first given. Would it have been reasonable for Adam to respond, hey, wait a minute, why can't we eat this tree? In the context of everything that God has done for Adam, that would have been ridiculous. It's only later when the serpent starts to say, did God place restrictions on you? Is it true that you're on a short leash? The big guy's got you on a short leash? You were created in the image of God. It doesn't make sense that you're on a short leash. And that's the line of thinking that he is going to develop. Okay. The serpent then sees that she is not prepared. She has not thought about the commandment. She has not thought about the graciousness of God. And so he begins he launches in a direct contradiction of what God has said. It says, and the serpent said to the woman, you surely shall not die. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. It's curious here. He's using the words that God had used in the original commandment that the woman omitted. He says, you will surely not die. He just negates it. He is directly contradicting what God had said. Here we have, there's a certain amount of credibility that the serpent brings to this, in a sense. Because here we have a creature in the garden who's a rebel. He is directly contradicting God. And yet, he is free to roam in this garden. There's a sense in which the woman can look at him and say, rebels do live. It could be that he's right, that shall not surely die. And she knows that she is not just a serpent, but she is man. She is the creature for whom all of creation led up, the pinnacle of creation, the one who is made in the image of God. So there's a certain amount of plausibility that comes with his claim. Then he gives an alternate explanation for this command that's all coming from the perspective of mistrust in God. He says, for in God knows in the day that you eat of it. Here comes the immediacy. He's bringing in the immediacy that she had omitted. God said, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. Here he says, in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened. In other words, what she is suggesting is that there was a stratagem on the part of God, that God purposely put restrictions on man to hold him back, to keep him in his place. And God knows that if he eats of that, he will realize what he was made to be. The glorious creature that he was made to be. If he strikes out, shows some initiative, decides for himself what is right and wrong, he will live up to his full potential. That's something that God doesn't want. That's why the restriction was placed there. God wants to keep him subservient and in his place, following rules. But in fact, man was made a better thing than that. Man is much more, a much more awesome creature than that. And if she takes that fruit and eats of it, she will be asserting herself. She will be establishing her own independence. And she will be choosing what is right and what is wrong. That's a line of argument that is very appealing to all of us, I think. Well, I know it's appealing to all of us. Because if there's... we may not be geniuses. We may not know everything. But there's one thing we know. And that is, I care about my own self-interest. God may be smarter. God may be the creator of everything. But he's a busy person. Does he really care about me as much as I do? Are all the commands, are all the things that he wants me to do, are those all in my interests? The example that maybe unfortunately always comes to mind when I think about this is paying insurance. Insurance is kind of a strange thing. I mean, why would anybody ever think of insurance? What are you doing in insurance? You're paying a company to put you first. You're paying a company to look out for your best interests. A great concept. But if you have to pay them, are they going to do it? If you have to pay someone to care about you, how much are they going to care about you? And when it comes down to it, just think about it. Anybody who's had dealings with an insurance company, I mean, your car gets wrecked or whatever, when it comes down to their interests versus your interests, which do they care about more? Any questions about that? I mean, they're in business to be in business. They're there to make money. When their interests conflict with your interests, their interests are going to win out. It doesn't matter how faithfully you've paid your premiums. Is God like an insurance company that when his interests collide with our interests, he's going to look out for his interests and not ours? I mean, you can think about, I mean, we've all struggled with that kind of thing. Does God really love us? Does he really have our best interests in mind? And that's the issue that the serpent is raising. If you start from a basis of mistrust, you can always explain anything through those lenses of mistrust. It's kind of like skepticism. If you decide you're going to doubt what you know, there's no stopping. You'll never find anything that you know for sure if you're skeptical enough. If you're distrustful enough, if you start from that assumption, it can never be disproved. Even the most selfless, sacrificing act that a person can do can be seen as being extremely devious. Here, the serpent is saying, start from a basis of mistrust. And if you start from the basis of mistrust, then everything that God is doing looks devious and sinister. He's out. He's ultimately only interested in his own interests. So the serpent's appeal is, take your life in your own hands. Look out for your own interests. No one else ultimately will. Take the fruit. Your eyes will be opened and you will realize that you are the best one to choose what is right and what is wrong. Now the next sentence is, I think, very revealing. Verse 6, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from the fruit and ate. After having heard what the serpent said, her whole perspective was changed. She now looks at the fruit, but she sees the fruit through different eyes. Did the fruit change? No. But her whole perspective has changed, so now the fruit looks different. It says that the tree was good for food. Can you tell that by looking? There are some very nice-looking berries that are poisonous. Some very nice-looking mushrooms that are deadly. You can't tell by looking, necessarily, that it's good for food. That it was a delight to the eyes. That's a judgment. That's a subjective assessment that she's making. And now it looks attractive. And that the tree was desirable to make one wise. You can't tell that by looking. So she has bought the argument of the serpent. She's looking at this tree now through the eyes of mistrust. And now the fruit looks like it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do to eat that. So she takes it and she eats. And she gives also to her husband who is with her, and he eats. So both of them are culpable. Both of them have violated the commandment that God had given. The response is, then in verse 7, then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. The serpent had said, your eyes will be opened. Their eyes were opened. Not opened in the way he had suggested, but they were opened. And they knew that they were naked. Remember back at the end of chapter 2, it had said that they were both naked and not ashamed. They were unaware, they were unself-conscious of their nakedness. Now they have violated God's command, and they have this sense that something's wrong. Not only that something's wrong, but they're self-conscious. They're ashamed. What they're feeling is guilt. But this is the first time they've ever felt guilt. They don't know it like we do. What do you do when you feel guilty and you don't know what you're feeling? Well, they just feel like they need to hide. They need that there's something that's got to be covered up. So they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings. So in this kind of comic response to their guilt, they sew together these leaves and cover themselves, thinking that they have adequately dealt with the problem. And it's almost comical in its naivete. Okay. I really think this is a fascinating story. It's the serpent comes along and through a simple question is able to reorient the woman's perspective, to plant a seed in her mind of mistrust in God. And then he is able to reinterpret the whole commandment through the eyes of mistrust in such a way that God turns out to be a sinister, devious being who is out to keep them in their place, to keep them from fulfilling their full potential. And having done that, she concludes that taking the fruit is a good thing. It's a good choice. It's the right choice. She takes it and she eats. And the man eats too, and they're both experiencing deep guilt as a result of it. The serpent never told a lie. He said, "For God knows in the day you eat of it, he says, you shall surely not die, but your eyes will be opened." Did they die? You can imagine Eve taking the fruit and eating it, and Adam's watching. And she doesn't drop dead. And she gives it to him. And he says, well, can't be that bad. That they didn't die. But God said that they would die. Well, there's a sense in which they did die that very day. And that's obvious because as soon as they ate of it, they sensed this nakedness. There was a death that occurred immediately. They didn't drop dead, but there was a death that occurred immediately. That spiritually they had died. And that's a problem that God is going to have to deal with. I'm sure that many of us remember the first time that we heard this story. And as we go on, there's a lot of grief and pain that is introduced into the world as a result of the disobedience of Adam and Eve. And we have probably all thought at some point in our life, well, maybe not all of us, but I remember I did when I heard this story as a youngster. I wish I had been there. Because I wouldn't have eaten the fruit. And all of that pain and evil would not have been introduced into the world. I'm smarter now. I know that I would have eaten that fruit. And I know that we all would have eaten that fruit. That we all, on a daily basis, we all face the same kind of thing. The same story is repeated day after day in all of our lives. We are all faced with temptations. And those temptations are of various kinds. It can be temptations with respect to money or power or sex or fame or anything else that is held by mankind to be valuable. We're all tempted by those things. We're tempted by some of those more than others. And we all have our own individual weak spots and other places where we are less vulnerable. But we are all, one time or another, tempted by all of the things that are held to be valuable in the world. Sometimes the temptations are long in the making. That it can be a complex situation that comes into being and reaches a point of culmination after many years. And then we face the moment of truth. Other times it could be in an instant. Just in an instant, something happens and we are faced with this question of what is right and what is wrong and what will I do? So these temptations come in all kinds of forms, all forms. They're different shapes, a different nature to them. And as a result, sometimes they don't even resemble this story in chapter 3. But ultimately, they all boil down to the same thing. And that is, can we trust God or can we not? Is God the God that the Bible says he is, or is he not? Can he be trusted to be looking out for my best interests, or can he not? And we all know that as we're proceeding through life, that question can be raised in lots of different ways and in ways that it is very difficult to answer the question, yes, God can be trusted. That over time, all of our weak spots get probed. And we either, at the moment of crisis, we either act in faith or we act in faithlessness. But we have all acted in faithlessness enough that we should know by now that had we been in the garden, we would have done the same thing. We too have a difficult time trusting in the goodness of God. It really looks like there are times when we are either God is malicious or he just doesn't care. But either way, we want to take things into our own hands and decide for ourselves what we will do and what we will not do. We will read later about how God addresses this problem. And I think the rest of Genesis is really a description of how God is going to address this problem. And there are a lot of different aspects to the way that he addresses it. But ultimately what he wants to do is take us who cannot trust God and make us into people that can trust God and do trust God. That there is a sense in which he reestablishes that faith, or rather, establishes it. And that's the process he takes us through in our lives, taking us from people who distrust him to people who trust him implicitly, no matter how difficult the situation may be and how hard it is to trust whether he has our best interests in mind. Okay. I'm going to throw it open for questions. There are a couple of other things that I was going to talk about, but I will see if there are questions first.
I'm not sure whether it was you on In Search of Truth or Jack and Christine talking about your teaching about this before, but I think it may have been Jack and Christine talking about your teaching on this, and it was something that I found really helpful, and I was wondering if you could talk about it a bit. I remember hearing about them eating of the fruit and realizing that they were naked and covering themselves. Reading about that when I was younger and thinking that they had been embarrassingly naive about the shamefulness of their nakedness, and now all of a sudden they realized. Kind of like the dreams you have where you're out in public and you don't realize until, you know, halfway through the party, oh my gosh, I'm naked, why didn't anyone tell me? And it's a horrible, shameful kind of experience. I'm not saying I have any of those dreams. But I've heard people talk about them. But, But it really helped me a lot when they or you slowed down with that and talked about the fact that our sexuality, our genitals are such a personal part of us, that it accessed to such a personal part of our soul, that what it was illuminated for them was that they themselves were shameful, that they were guilty. And so that it was not a odd response, I mean, certainly insufficient, certainly, but to then cover them, their reproductive organs, to cover their genitals because they were shameful. Mm-hmm. And that was just another kind of added more substance to it for me. And it also took away some of the idea that inherently our bodies are somehow icky things that we can kind of grow up with too, but that the shame is in our sinfulness, not in our physicality. Anyway, I was wondering if you could say what you thought about
the way we've seen this before. In chapter 2, we saw where Adam had presumably had this longing, but he didn't know what this longing was for. And we'll see this in other places as we're working through Genesis, that here. They ate the fruit, and there's a feeling, but they don't know exactly what that feeling is. They've never had it before. It's guilt, but they don't know what it is. And all they know is that now they have something to hide. But they don't know how to hide that. And their sense is, well, I've got to hide the me. I've got to hide what's most intimate, what's most me, in a sense. And so naturally then, what they cover up is their genitals, the most personal part of us. So I think that's what's going on there, and that's that makes some sense of what they're doing. It's not, like you say, it's not just complete silliness. It is a combination of this realization of guilt and then human psychology that's built into us, and they want to cover that which is most intimate and personal. Other questions?
I was just wondering if you could comment on what you think he meant by the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Well, I think that's difficult, but I think what it is what he wanted them to reflect upon is, how do we know what's good and evil? That this tree plays some kind of role in determining what is good and evil, what is right and wrong, and how we know that. And the way this tree, that God intended this tree to play that role, was for the man and the woman to think about that question: how do we know what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's evil? And they're looking at this, and God said, don't eat it. How do we know whether it's a good thing to eat that fruit or not? Well, it's a good thing because God said, don't do it. And God has demonstrated himself to be a good God who cares about us, who has our interests in mind. So that the role, the tree was named that because it really does force us to determine how we know what's good and what's evil. And in the context of trust, the way we know is because God said it. In the context of mistrust, though, a different meaning could be associated with that same name. We've got lots of questions. Let's take this one next.
talking, I guess, on one level, the eating the apple was like the death of innocence. And then I wondered if also on another level, originally when God created Adam and Eve, they were perfect. They were not designed to like live forever on earth. And then after this, you know, he said, you will die, but he didn't mean, you know, if you eat the apple, you will die. He didn't mean you will die today, but originally you wouldn't die, but now if you eat the apple, you will eventually die. And then when the serpent says, you know, you will not die today, that's how he gets around. You won't die today, but I'm going to mention that you will eventually die if you do this. You know, there's several levels going on here.
Yes, the way I put that together is, in the commandment, God said, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. The death that God was talking about was a spiritual death, I think. And so when they ate of it, they did in fact die immediately. But it was a spiritual death that they experienced. The physical death that was to come later was nothing but a further manifestation of that spiritual death. It was like, it was as though they had contracted a fatal disease at the moment they ate of the fruit that would eventually result in them physically dying. So that's the way I put those together. They did in fact die. And that's the death that God had said would happen. And that's really the more significant death.
Up to that point, it seems like death isn't something that's in their awareness. So how would they be thinking of death spiritually or physically, and what had they seen die, if anything?
Again, we don't really know, but presumably it would make no sense for God to say that in the day you eat of it, you shall surely... And what's that mean? So death has to have some kind of content to it. And in order for death to have some kind of content to it, they must have some experience of death. My assumption is that they have at least seen plants die. They've seen something die. Maybe they've seen animals die. But there is some reality that they have been aware of. They have seen it, and they can associate something meaningful to the term death. So by then analogy, you know that thing that you saw the plant do? That's what will happen to you if you eat of the fruit. And it could be that they understood that at a purely physical level. It could be, I don't know. But I don't think that's what God intended, because that's not what happened in the day that they ate of it. What happened in the day that they ate of it was they died spiritually. Margaret?
You mentioned you could imagine Adam watching Eve as she ate the apple to see what happened and then joining her. I've occasionally heard teachings not connected with this church where people have said that, the people teaching have said that the reason Adam ate was it was not a sinful act, but a sacrificial act on his part, realizing that his wife, with whom he was one, was going to be, something terrible was going to happen, and he didn't want her to go through it alone. So he joined her. So it was an act of love on his part, even though he recognized the consequences would be terrible. And I was just wondering if... you would talk a little bit about that and about what you think of that perspective, and maybe a little bit more of what the dynamic between Adam and Eve, what was going on, what was the problem.
I really wish we had more information on that, because that's a very curious thing. I'm sure that the reason for that interpretation is based on what it says in Timothy. I can't remember which one it is. Timothy 1, first, it's chapter 2, what, 15, something like that, where it says that the man was not deceived. I don't know. I'm not confident that I know what's going on in Timothy. But I'm sure that that's why people have interpreted Genesis 3 the way they have. They're trying to account for that. I think that it's remotely possible that that's what's going on in Genesis 3, but I think it's rather remote. It says that Adam was with her. Now, there are other places in Scripture where it will talk about someone and his wife with him, or someone and her husband with her, and it just means that they are married. But in this case, that would seem like a strange thing to say, because we've only got one man and one woman, and we know from the last chapter that they are husband and wife. So I don't think that's the meaning of with her there. I think it must mean that he was actually physically present. And the most reasonable interpretation to me, it seems, based on my experience, is that there is kind of, we are herd animals. Why do some things become popular when they become popular? I mean, who can explain Pokemon? I mean, why do some things become popular and other things don't become popular? What a mysterious phenomenon that we have in human culture, human interaction. Well, there's something about a group dynamic. I'm sure we've all seen it, where you've been to some meeting, and either the group is rather divided, or they're all kind of leaning in one direction, and some speaker will stand up and say something that's very compelling, and you can feel the moods changing in the whole room, but kind of at the same time, that it's all going in the other direction at the same time. My suspicion is that Eve is interacting with the serpent. Adam is standing right there, is starting out rather dubious, but is allowing the interaction to go on. He is curious. And when Eve is so bold as to actually take the fruit and eat it, he is a little surprised, not sure it's the right thing, but she eats it, and she lives. And decides, well, I'm not so sure, but it doesn't seem like the wrong thing, and she didn't die, and I'll go for it. I know that kind of thing can happen, and I'm just assuming that that's basically the dynamic that's taking place.
I wonder if he could have feared being back to that pre-Eve condition of knowing his emptiness and need. And so he, rather than give up the fulfillment of being married, mm-hmm. he opted to stay with her in a sense.
So that would be interpreting it in that he knew it was the wrong thing to do, but in solidarity with Eve, he goes ahead and does
maybe,
it.
Maybe, I mean, later in this chapter, we see the utter selfishness that this has brought them to.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't see it as an act of selfless love, mm-hmm. more of perceived
self-protection.
Self-interest. Yeah. Do you see any significance to the chronology of Adam having been the one to receive the commandment Do you think God repeated the commandment to both of them, or that Adam conveyed it and maybe altered it a bit, or?
Yeah. Yeah. The commandment was given before Eve was created. Clearly, Eve had knowledge of the commandment because she is able to basically repeat it back. Where did the distortion come in? And I pointed out the different pieces of distortion. Was it that Adam did not adequately pass it on to Eve? Or in Eve's mind, is that where the distortion took place? My guess is that both need to bear responsibility for it. Adam should have passed it along faithfully to Eve. And Adam should have thought through what the significance of the commandment was. And he should have impressed it upon her. If Adam was standing there when this whole thing happened, and he really understood the nature of the command and the gravity, he should have intervened. So Adam has plenty of culpability. But my assumption is that enough of it was passed on to Eve that she too had the responsibility to come to an understanding of what the commandment was and what it truly meant. So I don't think that we have any way of knowing exactly how the commandment was passed on and in what form it was passed on. But I think there's reason to believe that both are culpable for not having really worked it through and understood what was going on. Both should have.
I wondered if that suggested a reason why the serpent addressed himself to Eve rather than Adam.
Yeah, that is, I think, very significant that he comes to Eve and talks to Eve. And then what we see later is the first person that God comes to is man, not to Eve. And yet God clearly knows what has happened. So there is significance there, exactly the significance I don't feel confident of. But we do have Eve being the one who was made to be the helpmate for Adam. And yet she's the one that the serpent comes to, addresses, and is the one through whom the serpent carries out his deception. I think that's there is a significance there that is drawn upon by Paul later on in the New Testament. We've got questions over here. Let's start with Debbie and then.
I have two questions. One is more just a matter of curiosity, and that is, do we have any way of knowing how long it was from the creation till when this happened? I mean, it looks like it was on the eighth day, you know.
Yeah.
But,
no, we don't have any. I don't see any way. My assumption is that there has been some time. Mm-hmm. We know that Adam named the animals, and presumably that was something that was carried out thoughtfully and as a result of research. So that took time. We know that took time. My assumption is that a period of time has taken place. This isn't just the next day.
Yeah. Other question. I'm kind of finding myself struggling with this idea of obedience, purely out of just strictly obedience, and then balancing that with how do we know things. I was raised in a Christian home and was taught that I was a sinner, and if you had given me a true false question all my life, I would have said, yeah, I'm a sinner. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't been until later in my adult years that I really understand that I'm a sinner.
Right.
And following the rules has been something I've done pretty much all my life, and yet that hasn't given me a genuine goodness. You know, that's not where that comes from. So I'm just wondering, what is, if God made us to be knowers, and knowing and becoming wise is such a long process. I'm not quite sure how to put this question together, but I mean, it seems like things would have turned out so much better if we just all obeyed all the rules, uh-huh. and if Adam and Eve had just obeyed all the rules, and yet there seems to be a lack of genuine, or that we can't live, have a genuine fullness of who we are. I mean, there's something a little bit robotic about that, uh-huh. or uh-huh. something. So I wondered if you could address that tension.
God is not primarily concerned about us obeying the rules. I think that becomes clear. Because he could have achieved that other ways. What he wants is for us to be, to trust him completely. And in order for us to trust him completely, he had to have rules. Because without rules, there could be no disobedience. I mean, the rule was put there